This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Werner Herzog, directed the new film Cave of Forgotten Dreams. It's a 3D documentary about the Chauvet Cave in France that has cave paintings which are 30,000 years old, the oldest ones that scientists know of. The cave had been sealed off by fallen rock for over 20,000 years before French scientists discovered it in 1994. The climate and ecology in the cave are so delicate that visitors aren't allowed in, so it wasn't easy for Herzog to get permission to bring cameras and a small crew into the cave. As we'll hear, he had to follow strict rules. The results are remarkable, enabling us to see in 3D a glimpse of our prehistory, Paleolithic art, cave bear claw scratches, animal bones, and incredibly beautiful stalactites and stalagmites. Werner Herzog's other films include Aguirre, the Wrath of God, Fitzcarraldo, Nosferatu, and Grizzly Man. Those films are about men and one vampire who go to extremes, and Herzog is known as a filmmaker willing to endure extreme conditions to make his movies. Werner Herzog, welcome back to Fresh Air. Let me start by asking you to describe some of the cave paintings that you find most extraordinary.
Well, the whole ensemble of the cave and all the paintings is awesome. So it's very hard to single out one specific part of it. But for me, the most intense of all is the so-called panel of lions. You see lions, five, six, seven of them stalking something, their eyes with incredible intensity pointed, all exactly pointed at one object, and you don't know what they are stalking. So it's really very, very beautiful, very intense, very accomplished.
I was amazed at how some of the images were shaded in and there was a certain amount of depth implied in how they were shaded. I was expecting when I walked into your film to see amazing line drawings and stick figures, you know, and it's so much more sophisticated than that.
Well, I think art as it bursts on the scene 32,000 years ago is fully accomplished. It doesn't start with, I say it in quotes, primitive scribblings and first attempts like children would make drawings. No, it's absolutely and fully accomplished, and not in Roman and Greek antiquity or in Renaissance or in modern times painting has gotten any better.
No, the Chauvet Cave where you filmed wasn't discovered until 1994. Tell us some of the things that the keepers of the cave have been doing to keep it as untouched, as pristine as possible.
When they discovered the cave, they did everything right to preserve it. They immediately understood the importance of the cave. They would only very carefully move along the floor by spreading out sheets of plastic and step on it, because you could immediately see that there were fairly fresh tracks of cave bears. The cave bear actually went extinct 20,000 or so years ago, but there are still fresh tracks of them. And, of course, later, when scientists moved in, they did it with utmost caution, never touching anything. A metal walkway was built, and you never leave this walkway. All these precautions were necessary also for preserving the cave in a way that not too many people entering would leave with their breath some mold on the walls, which happened in the most famous other cave, Lascaux, in the Dordogne area of France. Too many tourists, too many visitors, with their exhalations, with their breath, created a mold on the wall that is now very hard to control, and the cave is categorically shut down now. Same thing with Altamira in the Pyrenees in Spain.
Well, before I ask you how you got into this cave and got permission to make a film about it, why did you want to make a film about the Chauvet Cave?
Since early adolescence, I have been fascinated by cave paintings. It actually was my personal awakening, independent awakening, intellectual awakening by seeing a book in a bookstore in the display. And it really shook me to the core, seeing an image of a horse, and it said prehistoric and Stone Age paintings, and I couldn't believe it. And I would pass by the window each week and try to earn money as a ball boy in tennis courts. And I hoped that nobody would buy the book. Apparently, I thought it was the only one. And finally, I bought it, and the kind of shudder of awe seeing these paintings is still in me somehow.
And is your interest in the paintings themselves, or also in the knowledge that there was, like tens of thousands of years ago, there was an instinct to make art, there was an instinct to represent the world?
Yes, it is. It is strange and very significant that all of a sudden we have the presence of what I would call the modern human soul. We should be careful to define what soul means, but all modernity is all of a sudden bursting on the scene. Neanderthal man actually did not have all this, and other civilizations did not have it. Earlier human beings did not represent the world in figurative means, painting, sculptures, and so on.
So this happens with Paleolithic man.
Yes, it does.
And it's the Paleolithic man who did the cave paintings at Chauvet?
Yes. I mean, more precisely, Aurignacian. It's a particular phase of earlier Paleolithic time.
So once you decided you wanted to make this film about the Chauvet cave, how did you get permission to go inside with a film crew and shoot it, considering how hard they've been working at the cave to keep people out of it so that the cave can be maintained?
Yes, of course, it was the biggest of all battles. We took our time. I had to approach the Ministry of Culture, but there's also the regional government which has to give its okay. And, of course, the scientists, the Council of the Scientists, have to see you and give their okay. And I was very lucky that the French Minister of Culture, Frédéric Mitterrand, he's a nephew of the former president, Frédéric Mitterrand turned out to be a great fan of my films. And in this respect, I already had some slight advantage, but French can be very territorial when it comes to their own patrimony, their patrimony, their legacy in art, in culture. And of course, me as a Bavarian filmmaker, why am I gonna do this and not a French one? So I think it was clear that I was kind of competent as a filmmaker, and probably the fervor, the fire inside of me concerning cave art, these paintings, was a convincing item. And otherwise, beyond giving everything that was in me into these discourses, beyond all this, I think I was just very, very lucky.
Well, what about the regional government and the scientists? Did they know your movies, and were they open to the idea of you doing the film?
Well, they had to be convinced, and I had to meet the scientists, and I had to explain myself, and I had to explain myself how I would do it technically. Of course, the restrictions were enormous. I was only allowed 4 hours a day for a week. I was only allowed 3 men with me. I was only allowed to carry along what we could carry in our hands, so we couldn't move heavy equipment in there and install it. Lights that would only emit light without any temperature. And, of course, all the restrictions. You never step off the metal walkway. This is why the crew sometimes could not hide away. You cannot just step behind the camera and hide, because you would step on the floor of the cave.
Right, and they wanted you to keep on the walk so that you didn't contaminate the rest of the cave.
It's not just contaminating. There are footprints, fairly fresh footprints. You do not want to superimpose your print of your hiking boot upon it.
over the cave bear print.
You just don't do this. And there's a footprint of a child, maybe 8 years old. This very mysterious. We couldn't film it. We were not allowed because it was deep in a recess of the cave. The mysterious thing is that next to this footprint, probably a boy, probably around 8 years old, parallel to it runs the footprint of a wolf. And I was very, very puzzled. Did the wolf stalk the boy, or did they walk together as friends? Or did the wolf leave its footprints 5,000 years later? Mm-hmm. It's stunning. The lapse of time is completely and utterly stunning.
Would you describe the first time you went into the cave and what the sensation was like of being in it?
Yes, I can describe it. I was allowed 1 hour before, about a month before I started shooting, because I insisted I had to have a quick look at what was awaiting me, how I could move, where I could put a camera, how big a tripod, for example, could be. So I was allowed 1 hour, and it was just a moment of complete awe. There's nothing else, just awe. And of course, surprises, because I was not prepared for the fact that the cave is so beautiful. It's like crystal cathedrals and stalactites and stalagmites, and just like a fairy tale universe down there. And then I was not prepared. I knew, yes, there were some bones, but there are actually 4,000 bones, mostly cave bear, today extinct, skulls, vertebrae, rib cages, 4,000 of them. Among them, not a single human bone, because there was no human habitation in this cave. They only used it for painting. So that's all the things you see first, and you're stunned by it because you didn't expect it. And then facing the paintings, it's just sheer awe, how beautiful and how accomplished they are.
And you mentioned it's this kind of crystal landscape. Everything is covered in this calcified crystal. Where does that come from?
Seeping water that actually leaves layers, creates formations of stalactites and stalagmites. What is also significant, it is so fresh. It is so as if it had been left yesterday. Things are so fresh, and all of a sudden you see painting of a cave bear, a charcoal painting, and about half an inch layer of calcite over it, which takes thousands of years to form. So you know this is not a forgery. That was actually the first indication. This is not a forgery. This is for real. And of course, through radiocarbon dating, you can establish fairly precisely when was the painting done. There are swipe marks of torches. You see, when a torch burns down, and in order to rekindle it, it's like cutting the wick of a candle. You swipe the torch against the wall, and little fragments of charcoal were analyzed through radiocarbon dating, and we know pretty precisely when somebody swiped this torch, something, let's say, 28,400 years ago.
What did the air feel and smell like in the cave when you first entered?
Well, it's slightly humid, and of course I have a perfumer, a master perfumer in the film, because there is a plan to recreate the cave three-dimensionally outside in some sort of what I call the Disneyland version, since nobody is going to be allowed in the cave. They will replicate the entire cave and replicate the paintings on the walls. And there was even a plan to recreate of course, in our imagination, the odor, the scent inside of the cave, which means maybe some carrion of rotting cave bears, some fire, some whatever, resins. And I found a master perfumer who describes, who fantasizes wildly about how the odor may have been 32,000 years ago. However, when you are entering there, it's slightly humid, no significant traces of any smell of anything prehistoric in there.
Would you describe how the people who discovered the cave managed to find it?
Yes, in particular, the main discoverer, Jean-Marie Chauvet, has been out there. And you have to understand there's a dramatic gorge and a stone arc, a natural arc, spans it. A fantastic piece of landscape, almost like out of a Wagner opera, like staging a Wagner opera. And apparently this has attracted prehistoric men. I think romanticism is not our property alone, not the property of the romanticists. There must have been a feeling among these people, because it's significant that six or seven other caves are like in a cluster around this spectacular arc. And they were out for trying to find other caves, and I think they mostly looked for drafts of air, very faint drafts of air. I think Chauvet put his cheek to the rocks and tried to feel something, and Eliette Brunel, I think with the back of her hand, was feeling around. They sensed a draft of air, cleared out debris and rocks, and found a shaft, a tunnel, a horizontal tunnel, barely wide enough to crawl into, and then it ends up in a vertical drop, and they were in there. And they immediately sealed it off again when they saw the importance of what they had found. They did everything right, everything.
Why did you want to use 3D? And a lot of people are asking the question, 3D to show two-dimensional cave paintings? Why do you need 3D?
Well, that was my opinion. When I saw photos, it looked almost like flat walls, maybe slightly undulating or so. And thanks God, I went in there without any camera a month before shooting. And what you see in there, it's limestone, and you have these wildly undulating walls. You have bulges and niches and pendants of rock. And there's a real incredible drama of formation. And the artists utilized it for their paintings, for the drama of paintings. You see a horse that comes out very shyly out of a recess, of a niche. You see wild use of pendants or bulge of the rock. Now is a bulging neck of a bison coming at you. So it was immediately clear there, not only clear, it was imperative to do this in 3D, as we were probably the only ones ever allowed to film.
And also, like, the stalactites and stalagmites in 3D are really remarkable to behold.
Yes.
So you were only allowed not only a limited amount of time, but a limited amount of space. You couldn't lug in whatever equipment you wanted to. It had to be proportionate to the walkway that you were confined to, and
exactly,
to the proportions of the cave. So did you have to customize your equipment in order to even bring it in?
We did, yes. And, of course, 3D cameras are fairly clumsy. And, of course, we were not allowed to have support from outside. You see, the climate in the cave is so delicate. They open the steel door for entering, and they open it for getting us out. But if we had forgotten something, yes, we would open the door again, but that would have meant the end of the day of shooting. And for 3D, when you have a wider shot and you see a large part of the cave and you move very close into one particular painting, you have to reconfigure your entire camera. You have to build literally build a different camera, because in 3D, the two eyes, or rather the two lenses, have to move closer to each other. And when you are fairly close, these two eyes or lenses have to squint slightly. So in semi-darkness, only with a few screwdrivers and with the help of torchlight, we built our own camera for closer shots, but which you can do if you have real, real competent, good people with you.
Well, and you'd never worked with 3D before, so you were just adjusting to it yourself.
Well, you have to be quick, and you better do it. You better do it right, because that's the only shot you have.
One of the things I especially liked about your use of 3D is that you used it to represent as accurately as you could the unique, rare world of this cave, as opposed to some kind of fantasy world where, you know, you're using 3D for special effects. Like, there isn't a part in your movie where it's like, oh my God, that bird is flying into the audience. He's in front of my face. You know, you're not using it to like scare or shock the audience. You're using it to show what's going on in this cave. What did you learn about visual perception from working in 3D? Do you feel like you started seeing things differently knowing that you were shooting it on 3D?
Yes, I saw things differently, and not only seeing it, it's a form of narration. When you start editing, and you have to be aware you cannot edit very fast, and that's a mistake of many of the 3D films nowadays. They use the same very quick cut technique of action movies. However, our eye, our brain needs a little more time to adapt to a new three-dimensional shot or reality. So they are cutting too fast. I always understood 3D not only as a specific spatial formation. I also sensed there was a certain different way of time of narrating it, immersing yourself with music into it. So it's a highly complex thing. And of course, in a very complex way, I saw the cave differently, and that's how I shot it.
Is 3D asking our eyes and our brains to process images differently than a two-dimensional film?
Yes, it is. It's a little bit like when you listen to sound when you're in a street cafe and noise around you and traffic noise. The brain is very selective. We only hear what you are saying opposite to me, and we filter out the rest. But when you listen to a tape recording of it, it's very hard to even make out what we said to each other. And it's similar with 3D filming or 2D filming. 3D filming never somehow allows you to step back into an easy mode where you can filter things out. Our brain is made to avoid 3D most of the time. We have one dominant eye, which sees only in 2D, and a peripheral second, the other eye, peripherally, only sees in 3D. So the brain is lazy and tries to avoid seeing 3D. And in a 3D movie, we are forced to see 3D all the time. And it's in a way, it's tiring.
Now, there's a scene in your documentary about the cave in which you're talking about the possibility, with all the torches inside, that our ancestors would have been able to see their shadows and see shadows
yes,
on the wall.
Most certainly, yes.
Yes, and that leads you to think about shadow dancing, and that leads you to think about Fred Astaire in the shadow dancing scene, and then you show the Fred Astaire.
I couldn't help it.
You couldn't
I
help
could
it.
Not help it.
No, I have to stop you here. Wait. I actually met you a few years ago at a reception after you after a screening of your films at the University of Pennsylvania. And you were talking about how you had been watching Fred Astaire films. So I thought, okay, I see how Fred Astaire ended up in this documentary about a 30,000-year-old cave, because you were watching Fred Astaire films. Go ahead.
Yes, that is correct. Yeah, it is actually arguably, or for me certainly, the greatest single sequence in all of film history. Fred Astaire dancing with his own shadows, and all of a sudden he stops and the shadows become independent and dance without him, and he has to catch up with them. I mean, it's just so quintessential movie. It can't get more beautiful. It's actually from Swing Time. And when you look at the cave and there are certain panels, there's evidence of some fires on the ground. They were not for cooking. They were, because there's no evidence of any habitation in there, they were used for illumination. You have to step in front of these fires to look at the images. And of course, when you move, you must see your own shadow. And immediately Fred Astaire comes to mind, who did something 32,000 years later, which is essentially what we can imagine for early Paleolithic people.
Now, the question comes up, what's the difference between a Werner Herzog documentary about a cave and anybody else's, you know, National Geographic documentary about a cave? And I think you just answered that in a way, that your imagination is seeing all these connections. Suddenly Fred Astaire is shadow dancing in your movie. And, you know, you're talking, you know, in your narration, not just about the fact, but about things it makes you think about.
Yes, and our imagination and our entire approach as human beings. How do we enter a cave like this? How do we experience it? How does it surpass our wildest dreams? All this, I think, you would not see in a National Geographic documentary.
As wonderful as those National Geographic documentaries are.
Mine are better. Sorry for saying that. I say it only in quotes.
Okay.
My apologies, National Geographic. Accept my apologies. But I think my films are different. And I think the way I shot and present Cave of Forgotten Dreams is different, and it's a position which moves away from what you normally expect from a documentary. We have to deal with reality in new ways. We have to find a new answer to all these dramatic shifts in perception of reality.
And that's all there is. I'll just say I'm glad that your films and National Geographic films exist.
All right, let's accept it like that. There's cohabitation.
Cohabitation, exactly.
Yes.
So when I was watching your cave documentary, and there were references to cave bears that existed then and are now long extinct, I couldn't help but think of the documentary that you made, Grizzly Man, which is such a terrific film. And it's a documentary about Timothy Treadwell, this guy who went to the wild to film grizzly bears and saw himself as like the friend of the grizzlies, but it was not an environment that a human belonged in. And eventually he was eaten. He and his girlfriend were eaten by a bear. And he actually got that on audio tape, and the audio tape survived their deaths. So thinking about when you were in the cave and thinking about all the cave bears that used to be in there, did you think about Grizzly Man?
I always think in a way about Grizzly Man. Whenever I step out into nature or wild nature, I immediately have Timothy Treadwell present. And of course, he marks a position which, of course, was tragic, a tragic misunderstanding of wild nature. He romanticized it, and he saw it as if the bears were all like in Walt Disney movies, friendly, fluffy creatures. Of course, they are ferocious, and they ultimately eat you, and they kill you. So Treadwell is always present in my life. I can't just discard this incredible man, this wonderful man in a movie. He's always around somehow.
You seem to really be attracted to, I know I'm stating the obvious here, to extreme personalities and extreme environments. In terms of personalities, you have Timothy Treadwell from Grizzly Man, the character of Aguirre, the Wrath of God. And then, of course, you're attracted to extreme environments. You did a documentary about this recently discovered cave that's 30,000 years old. You did a documentary about discoveries in Antarctica. Do you consider yourself to be an extreme personality?
Difficult question. No, I don't think so. I'm a professional. I'm a filmmaker. And I think what you are trying to combine makes a lot of sense. Many people tell me, you have been everywhere. You have shot in the Amazon, in the Sahara Desert, in Antarctica even. That would be horizontally spreading out, but I've always tried to look deep into the human condition. This is why I do a film on Timothy Treadwell. This is why I film Aguirre, The Wrath of God, and other films. So it's always a look deep into the abyss, into the deepest recesses of the human soul, or as far as you can scrutinize with a camera. And it's maybe significant at the moment I'm doing a film on death row inmates, and I thought about a title, and I came up with Gazing into the Abyss. And then the name of a person on death row, like Joseph Garcia on death row, Michael Perry on death row, Linda Carty on death row. So, but all under the umbrella title, Gazing into the Abyss. And all of a sudden it dawned on me, well, that would have been a great title for the Cave film. It would have been a great title for Timothy Treadwell. It would have been a great title for Aguirre, The Wrath of God, as if I was more somebody who was vertically looking as deep as it gets.
So I know one of the questions that interests you about the Cave, I think this is one of the questions that interests you, is were there kind of like spiritual ceremonies there? Is that one of the uses of the Cave? And I'm wondering if you have ever practiced religion, because I think one of the musics you're interested in is Gregorian chant.
Yes, of course, it's a variety of questions, but we can assume that there was probably some religious ceremonies there, maybe shamanistic, although today we should touch this term only with a pair of pliers, because a New Age vapid babble about pseudo-philosophy abuses shamanism. So probably something like that, but we simply do not know. We just do not know. But when you see an altar like rock and very carefully placed, almost like staged, a fresh skull of a cave bear on it, and evidence of charcoal around it as if they were fumigating it, it's not illegitimate to say this probably was a staging for a religious ceremony. We do not know, and I think the newer generation of archaeologists points out we have to take it as it is. This is what we see. Whether it was religious or not, we will never know.
And yourself?
Well, I had an intense religious phase in my adolescence, and I do understand religious sentiment. I do understand the quest for something higher, something beyond us. Has been a very dramatic phase in my life, and although I'm not a religious person anymore, it has left me in a way. But I do understand people who are deeply religious.
Well, Werner Herzog, thank you so much for talking with us.
You're very welcome.
Werner Herzog's new 3D documentary is called Cave of Forgotten Dreams. You can watch the scene of Fred Astaire dancing with his shadows on our website, freshair.npr.org. Okay, we're going to go from one extreme to another, from cave to desert. Our critic at large, John Powers, has a review of a new film set in Chile's harsh northern desert. It's called Nostalgia for the Light, and it's directed by Chilean filmmaker Patricio Guzman. He first won international attention in the late 1970s with his three-part epic, The Battle of Chile, which has been called one of the greatest documentaries ever made. He's made numerous films on everything from liberation theology to explorers who trace the roots of Jules Verne novels. John says Nostalgia for the Light grapples with the deepest mysteries of life.
Perhaps the most famous line in late 20th century literature comes from Milan Kundera. "The struggle of man against power," he wrote, "is the struggle of memory against forgetting." One man who never stopped struggling is Patricio Guzman, the Chilean filmmaker who was imprisoned during the U.S.-backed coup that toppled Chile's elected president, Salvador Allende, and installed a military dictatorship that lasted the next 17 years. Guzman's documentaries have done as much as anything to keep alive the world's memory of what happened to his country that September 11th, 1973. Of course, it's been 38 years since the coup, and Guzman is now 70. Though he hasn't forgotten anything, he's moved beyond horrified anger. In fact, he's never made a more beautiful or profound movie than his new one, Nostalgia for the Light, an exquisitely shot essay on ultimate things, time, space, memory, and how creatures so small and frail as human beings find meaning in a gigantic cosmos. Nostalgia for the Light focuses on the Atacama Desert, a 600-mile stretch of high plateau in northern Chile that is the driest place on Earth. It never rains. Composed of salt, sand, and lava, the place has the bleak, ravishing beauty of a distant and forbidding planet. But because it's so high, so dry, and so far from big cities, its clear skies make it home to some of the world's great observatories. At night, the stars shine so brightly, they cast shadows. Nothing grows in the Atacama Desert, but it does draw three kinds of people, all searching for the truth of the past. There are the astronomers who study light from outer space, which means that what they're seeing in their telescopes is always something that already happened, but is only now reaching Earth. There are the archaeologists who study the rock paintings and beautifully preserved bodies of the pre-Columbian peoples who traveled across the landscape. And finally, there are the old women who wander this vast desert with tiny shovels, looking for the remains of their sons, daughters, and husbands. You see, the dictatorship used this hostile environment to jail political prisoners. They housed them in a desolate 19th-century mining camp, and to dump the bodies of those it had murdered. These women seek the past with particular urgency, heroically, obsessively, almost crazily searching for what became of their loved ones. In fact, they're after the truth behind the physical remains. But historical memory is an iffy business in Chile. In Santiago a few years ago, I got on the subway near the statue commemorating Salvador Allende, and I got out across from September 11th Avenue, a street commemorating the coup that ended in his death. But the coup happened nearly 40 years ago. That's why Guzman went to the Atacama Desert to shoot under its millions of stars. He knew that this landscape puts any event, not least a coup in a small, isolated country, into cosmic perspective. In fact, it threatens to reduce anything human to just a speck in time and space. Which is to say, this movie isn't only about Chile. Guzman's movie got me to thinking about the historical traumas whose ripples still touch my own untraumatized life in Southern California. American slavery, the Armenian genocide, the Holocaust, the Vietnam War, the repression in Central America. For those who've survived such tragedies, or live intimately with their aftershocks, the questions are tricky and painful. How do we remember and honor our victims without letting their suffering define us, or imprison us, or make us fight the same battles over and over? How do we hold on to the past, yet let go? I don't know the answer to such questions, but I do know that there's no single correct one. Watching Nostalgia for the Light, I suddenly remembered visiting the memorial to the Jewish heroes who fought the Nazis in the Warsaw Ghetto. I was surrounded by an Israeli school group, whose teachers, moved to tears by what struck them as sacred ground, were aghast to see their students giggling, horsing around, and flirting. In short, being teenagers. And though my brain sympathized with the adults who honored the memory of those bloodstained cobblestones, my body was on the side of the kids, who were living, breathing, exuberant proof that life goes on.
John Powers is film critic for Vogue and Vogue.com. He reviewed Nostalgia for the Light by Chilean filmmaker Patricio Guzman. Coming up, a recording by saxophonist Tim Byrne that was lost and now 14 years later has been released. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead will have a review after a break. This is Fresh Air. Our jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has a review of a new release by Brooklyn-based saxophonist and composer Tim Byrne. Kevin says Byrne is one of the underrated composers and bandleaders in contemporary jazz, and that this new album really shows off his strengths. ¶¶
Saxophonist Tim Byrne came up on New York's so-called downtown scene 30 years ago. That scene's known for postmodern jump cutters like John Zorn, who'd leap from one style to another in the space of a beat. But Byrne went another way. He's fascinated by gradual transitions. In his music, improvisers take their time, wending their way from theme to theme over a long, continuous set. That's one of the shortest transitions on Tim Byrne's album Insomnia, a lost and found live recording from 1997, now out on the Clean Feed label. The music sounds so fresh, that 14-year wait is barely worth mentioning. It's pre-stood the test of time. Byrne plays in all sorts of combos, but the sound here is more sumptuous than usual, owing to expanded resources. Eight pieces include a string trio of violin, cello, and bass, augmented by a rhythm instrument rare in improvised music. Mark Ducrey plays acoustic 12-string guitar with a woody, steely, ringing sound. Here's Ducrey with trumpeter Bikita Carroll, bassist Mike Formanek, and drummer Jim Black. Tim Byrne likes very long pieces where players drop in and out. The shorter of two suites on his new Insomnia runs half an hour. But he brings a keen sense of proportion to the music, even when the players spend far more time inching between melodies than playing those lovely themes themselves. The tunes are sturdy bridge piers, supporting the improvisations that span them. Early on, Byrne learned from his mentor Julius Hempel the power of majestic long tones and of taking your time in a music where players often hurry. Tim Byrne's written lines are dissonant but orderly. Their strong shapes are ready-made for improvised paraphrase. Sometimes, a renegade soloist will spin variations right over the melody, so you get the tune and improvisation at the same time. I love the undulating texture of Tim Byrne's octet sound, as Chris Speed's clarinet melds with violin, and violin with cello, and cello with Byrne's alto sax, and his baritone sax with bass. That blurring of timbres adds an air of mystery, like ghostly figures passing through long exposure photographs. But the progress of Byrne's long suites is like a road novel, full of picaresque or elliptical episodes, with heroes who end up far from where they started. Or put it yet another way, Tim Byrne is a master of slow cooking. He keeps you waiting, but it's worth it.
Kevin Whitehead is a jazz columnist for eMusic.com and the author of the book Why Jazz? A Concise Guide. He reviewed Tim Byrne's new album Insomnia on the Clean Feed label. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Jenny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our associate producer for online media is Melody Kramer. Roberta Shirok directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.